This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I'd like to say a few things about T.C. Boyle. Welcome him to the University of California at San Diego. I understand he's standing back there waiting to make a dramatic entrance. I think there are a few writers today who've captured our modern idioms of life better than T.C. Boyle. His remarkable short stories and amazing novels, my favorite is The Road to Wellville, show us how language itself fractures under the weight of irony and implication. Everything we thought we were saying dissipates in these books. And they're remarkable essays, not just in fiction, but in our own contemporary vernacular English. His works have been translated into over 20 languages, and he's recently segued from a distinguished full-time teaching career at USC, which has spanned over 3 decades, into a new position of writer-in-residence at USC. Anyone opening a copy of The New Yorker, The Paris Review, The Atlantic Monthly, McSweeney's in the past few years will be able to find his remarkable fiction. I want to share a personal story. I myself am particularly fond, indeed I cherish that moment, of a dozen years ago when I bought a BMW. And when I bought my BMW, I was given a free 1-year subscription to BMW magazine. And in the first issue I received, there was a wonderful essay by T.C. Boyle on the thrills of driving his 3 red BMWs. His descriptions of the cars careering down the coastline from Montecito, where he lives, to USC, where he was teaching, were really breathtaking. And I feel that thanks to that essay, I now not only own the ultimate driving machine, but the ultimate imagination machine. Just yesterday, I read in the New York Times the wonderful interview he gave to the Times reporter Andrew Goldman in the Sunday Times magazine. There he says, quote, "You want, as an artist, to be pushing yourself to do what you haven't done before. I can think of no artist who's pushed himself, whether behind the keyboard or the dashboard, as much as T.C. Boyle. His new novel is San Miguel, and Dan has told you that there are copies for sale out in the lobby. It's a book about a woman trapped on an island off the coast of California. It's set in the 1930s, but it's full of allusions to Shakespeare's Tempest. The recent review in the British newspaper The Independent called the book masterful. I'm sure it is, and I look forward to reading it. And I look forward, too, to hearing Tom Boyle tonight read from some of his work and answer some of the questions from the audience and talk about what it means to be a working writer in America today. And so it is my pleasure to welcome T.C. Boyle to the University of California at San Diego.
Debate? What debate? Actually, thank you, Seth, and thank you, Dan. I've had some odd collisions of circumstances. For instance, once I was performing on stage in Dallas at the very moment that the Super Bowl was starting in Houston. And I thought, you know, who's going to come to this? You know, maybe some Chinese dissidents and Sherpas or something. The place was packed with people who don't like football. I personally wanted to see the game, but, you know. Speaking of football, I'm on a long book tour here. I happened to be in Seattle a few weeks ago when Green Bay Packers were playing Seattle. And so all day long, I saw all these people in football jerseys. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of people in football jerseys with the name of the team on the back and the name of their favorite player on the back and his number. And I had a negative epiphany. I began to realize that football is bigger than literature because not a single person in the entire city had a Penguin jacket on with my name on it. But maybe we'll correct that. We'll start to correct that tonight. As Seth said, I would like to tell you a little bit about the new novel, but what I'd like to do also is read you a short story, beginning, middle, and end, because while I like talking about literature, and I do it with my students, and I do it on TV shows, and I do it in forums like this, what I like best is to have a direct experience of it. I was pretty much of a squirrely, hyperactive kid, as you can imagine. We didn't have psychologists and Ritalin when I was a kid. We just had a back door. So I spent most of my boyhood out of doors, running wild. However, my mother taught me how to read, and I can still hear her voice. Further, I see one of my old classmates here tonight, Anne Marie Sprinkle. We had an eighth grade English teacher at Lakeland High School in New York by the name of Donald Grant. He was an amateur actor, and if we were good on Fridays, and you know, we were pretty good, he would read us aloud. He would perform stories for us, the old chestnuts like To Build a Fire and The Most Dangerous Game, and we'd go out of the classroom trembling. So to the two of them, I owe my love for giving you stories. That said, let me tell you a little bit about San Miguel. Last year, I published When the Killing's Done. My wife and I moved up to Santa Barbara from L.A. Just about 20 years ago now. And I've written several books in that time, many books in that time. All the while, though, I kept driving up the coast and looking at the Channel Islands, wondering what goes on out there. Well, now I know. So When the Killing's Done, which came out last year, concerns Santa Cruz Island and Anacapa Island and the fight in the past decade over the removal of invasive species. The biologists and the Park Service and the Nature Conservancy felt that on Anacapa, the invasive rats must be removed because they were negatively impacting the birds, which, you know, evolved to nest on the ground. And on the larger island, the sheep first had to be removed and then the feral pigs. It's quite a wonderful story, actually. And I'll just give you a tiny taste of what got me going on this. The Park Service decided on around Thanksgiving in 2001 to bomb Anacapa Island with rat poison for 2 days. Come over with helicopters, drop rat poison on the island. Well, some animal rights activists kind of opposed this idea. They got them a little bit riled. The rats, by the way, had got there in 1856 when a paddle wheel steamer coming from San Francisco wrecked on the rocks. No one was hurt. Everyone survived. But the rats got there. So now it was time to remove them by dropping rat poison on the island. One guy, and I didn't meet him, I didn't know, all I knew was what I read in the newspaper, who became the principal character of my book, was known in the news as the rat savior because he went out to the island with a Confederate and two giant backpacks full of vitamin K, which is the antidote to the rat poison, and scattered it all over the island in order to save the rats. He was arrested for feeding wildlife in a national park without a permit. So how could you make this stuff up, you know? So I began to examine that and wrote a book about the fight over the restoration of the ecology there. And, of course, it's also a turf war. I mean, who owns this property? It's a national park. But really, who owns it and what gives us the right as great big carnivorous apes, although I'm mainly a vegetarian myself, to dominate these other animals and to use them for our purposes and to privilege one against the other. For instance, when my kids were little, they had a pet rat. You know, this white rat, it was beautiful, it was intelligent, it climbed on their shoulder, you know. Meanwhile, 2 feet away behind the wall where its feral cousins, you know, making noise all night long. And we privilege the one, and we try to get rid of the others. So I tried to examine that in When the Killing's Done. While I was doing that, though, I discovered two historical stories set on San Miguel Island. San Miguel is the farthest one out. It's got the roughest seas. It's the coldest, the windiest. It's known as the graveyard of the Pacific. To get to Santa Cruz Island from where I live, it's an hour and a half by boat over very, very rough seas. The Channel Islands National Park is the least visited of all our national parks for the simple reason that you have to hang your head over the side of a boat and vomit for an hour and a half just to get there. It's 4 hours over even rougher seas to get to San Miguel. There's nothing there but a ranger station with a couple of beds in it and a ranger. That's it. That's all that's there. I discovered this story through a narrative that was published by the Santa Cruz Island Foundation and our local historian, Marla Daly. And there are actually two stories involved here. One takes place in 1888, and it's the diary of Marantha Waters. She moved out to this island with her husband in order to make their fortune raising sheep on this island. And they're sole possessors of this place. She was 38. She lived in San Francisco, an upper-middle-class woman. She had an apartment, a cat, a piano, an adopted daughter named Edith, and a second husband, Will, who was a Civil War veteran, and convinced her to spend the $10,000 her first husband had left her to buy into this. The problem was she had consumption. And in those days, the only cure, if there were going to be a cure, was to have rest and have clean air. Well, she was in San Francisco. We all know how miserable the weather is in San Francisco. You know, it's foggy, it's windy, it's cold. And he convinced her to move to San Miguel with him, where it would be much better for her health. After all, it is in the south, all the way down to Santa Barbara. Big mistake. This is where the northern current coming down from San Francisco collides with the southern current coming up from this area. And it produces very fruitful seas for wildlife, but it's also very bad weather, much worse than San Francisco. Marantha lasted about 6 months and left a diary, 50 pages or so, of just day-to-day life. On the island with her, Will, the husband, Marantha, her adopted daughter, Edith, a boy about Edith's age named Jimmy, who was a farmhand, an older farmhand named Adolf, and a maid named Ida. That was it. That was the entire society for this time that they were there. They didn't have handheld devices. They played cards. They sang to each other, you know, and they lived life as best they could in this really hostile environment. Marantha went back ashore 6 months later, and 2 years later she died of consumption. Meanwhile, her daughter Edith had the ambition to be a stage actress, a singer and dancer, and she was in school studying music. And just like in some fairy tale, the evil stepfather, Will, didn't like the fact that she was in San Francisco in a private school outside of his dominance. Maybe, who knows, dating boys. So he took her out of school, brought her back to the island, and kept her there to be the servant, to clean, cook, and so on. So now the cast is reduced to four. Just Edith, who was now 17, Captain Waters, Adolf, and Jimmy. I mean, it's like the cast of a Eugene O'Neill play. And I was fascinated by this. So I have a book that's divided into three sections, and it all takes place in San Miguel. The first is from Marantha's point of view. The second is from Edith's point of view. And in the time she was there with her stepfather, all she tried to do was escape this island. But it was very little visited, occasionally by fishermen or, you know, casual sailors and so on, sealers capturing seals for San Diego SeaWorld and things like that. Whether or not she escaped, I know, but I will leave it to you to find out. The third part of the book is about the Lester family, and I was just struck by the coincidences between these two families. In 1930 through 42, the Lesters lived there, and it was the same kind of thing. A woman also of 38, her name was Elise Lester. She was a librarian at the New York City Library. She was sort of awkward and the ugly duckling of her family, a spinster, and, of course, extremely elderly, 38 years old and unmarried. And she met a First World War veteran named Herbie Lester, a guy who was handsome, dynamic, and had a real good idea. Let's farm sheep on San Miguel and make our fortune and be away from all of the other society. They moved out there, and they were happy. She was happy. She was married. It was wonderful. And even though she was extremely elderly, she bore two daughters. And this family in the 30s became quite well known in America. Here we had the Depression. We had bread lines. We had soup kitchens, people desperate to find a way out. And they were the sole possessors of this island, living there in this idyllic sort of life. Life magazine did a whole story on them, the Swiss Family Lesters. And Bessie Smith took them up on her radio show. People really, even today, all of us today, 7 billion people on the world, who doesn't want your own island and your own law, no taxes, to live in nature? And they did very well, and their lives are extremely happy. But, you know, happiness doesn't necessarily make for the best fiction. So there was a little bit of misery involved. And again, I'll let you read the book and find that out for yourselves. So, since we have a little bit of time left, I'd like to give you just a very little taste of the beginning of the novel, and then I'd like to read you a short story. Okay, so here is how the novel begins, and it's from Marantha's point of view, as I have already explained. She was coughing. Always coughing, and sometimes she coughed up blood. The blood came in a fine spray, plucked from the fibers of her lungs and pumped full of air as if it were perfume in an atomizer. Or it rose in her mouth like a hot metallic syrup, burning with the heat inside her till she spat it into the porcelain pot and saw the bright red clot of it there like something she'd given birth to, like afterbirth. But then what would she know about it, since she'd never conceived, not with James, her first husband, and not with Will either? She was 38 years old, and she'd resigned herself to the fact that she would never bear a child, not in this lifetime. When she felt weak, when she hemorrhaged, and the pain in her chest was like a medieval torture, like the pain forte et dur in which the torturer laid one stone atop the other till your ribs cracked and your heart stalled, she sometimes felt she wouldn't even live to see the year out. But that was gloomy thinking, and she wasn't going to have it, not today. Today she was hopeful. Today was New Year's Day, the first day of her new life, and she was on an adventure, sailing in a schooner out of Santa Barbara with her second husband and her adopted daughter Edith and half the things she owned in this world, bound for San Miguel Island, and the virginal air Will insisted would make her well again. And she believed him. She did. Believed everything he said, no matter the look on Carrie Abbott's face when she first gave her the news. "Marantha, no, you're going where?" Carrie had blurted out before she could think, setting down her teacup on the low mahogany table in her parlor overlooking San Francisco Bay and the white-capped waves that jumped and ran in parallel streaks across the entire breadth of the window. "To an island? And where is it again?" And then she paused, her eyes retreating. I hear the air is very good down there," she said, "very salubrious." And the little coal fire she had going in the grate flared up again. "And it'll be warmer, certainly. Warmer than here, anyhow." So that's how it begins, folks. And, you know, I really want to read you the entire novel except for the last paragraph, but they tell me we only have 6 hours here tonight. And those doors are locked behind you. That's why I came in on this side. Actually, I will give you the story I promised instead, because, again, this way you get the whole thing and you don't have to hear just a section. Yes? Are we ready? Okay. Thank you. The story is dedicated to everyone in the audience tonight who has now or has had a job that is unsatisfying. A job maybe that you don't really like very much. And I'm speaking to the students here too, you know, having to go to class tomorrow. And maybe you just can't face going in. And so you call your boss and you tell a little fib. Maybe you tell your boss that you're ill when in fact you're not. There are consequences. This story is called The Lie. I'd used up all my sick days and the two personal days they allowed us, but when the alarm went off and the baby started squalling and my wife threw back the covers to totter off to the bathroom in a hobbled two-legged trot, I knew I wasn't going into work. It was as if a black shroud had been pulled over my face. My eyes were open, but I couldn't see. Or no, I could see. The pulsing LED display on the clock radio, the mounds of laundry and discarded clothes humped round the room like the tumuli of the dead, a hard driving rain drooling down the dark vacancy of the window. But everything seemed to have a film over it, a world coated in Vaseline. The baby let out a series of scaled back cries. The toilet flushed. The overhead light flicked on. My wife, Clover, was back in the room, the baby flung over one shoulder. She was wearing an old cramps T-shirt she liked to sleep in and nothing else. I might have found this sexy to one degree or another, but for the fact that I wasn't at my best in the morning, and I'd seen her naked save for one rock and roll memento T-shirt for something like 1,000 consecutive mornings now. It's 6:15, she said. I said nothing. My eyes eased shut. I heard her at the closet. And in the dream that crashed down on me in that instant, she metamorphosed from a rippling human female with a baby slung over one shoulder to a great shining bird springing from the brink of a precipice and sailing on great shining wings into the void. I woke to the baby, on the bed beside me. "You change her," my wife said. "You feed her. I'm late as it is." We'd had some people over the night before, friends from the pre-baby days, and we'd made margaritas in the blender, watched a movie, and stayed up late talking about nothing and everything. Clover had shown off the baby, Zanna. We'd named her Zanna after a character in one of the movies I'd edited, or actually logged, and I'd felt a rush of pride. Here was this baby, perfect in every way, beautiful because her parents were beautiful, and that was all right. Tank, he'd been in my band, co-leader, co-founder, and we'd written songs together till that went sour, said she was fat enough to eat, and I'd said, "Yeah, just let me fire up the Barbie," and Clover had given me her little drawn-down pout of disgust because I was being juvenile. We stayed up till the rain started. I poured one more round of margaritas, and then Tank's girlfriend opened her maw in a yawn that could have sucked in the whole condo and the street out front, too, and the party broke up. Now, I was in bed, and the baby was crawling up my right leg, giving off a powerful reek of The clock inched forward. Clover got dressed, put on her makeup, and took her coffee mug out to the car and was gone. There was nothing heroic in what I did next, dealing with the baby and my own car and the stalled nose-to-tail traffic that made the 3 miles to the babysitters seem like a trek across the wastelands of the earth. It was just life, that was all. But as soon as I handed Zanna over to Violetta at the door of her apartment that threw up a wall of cooking smells, tearful Telemundo dialogue, and the diachronic yapping of her 4 chihuahuas, I slammed myself into the car and called in sick. Or no, not sick. My sick days were gone, I reminded myself. And my personal days, too. My boss picked up the phone. "Iron House Productions," he said, his voice digging out from under the R's. He had trouble with R's. He had trouble with English, for that matter. "Hello, Radko?" "Yes, it is he. Who is it now?" "It's me, Lonnie." "Let me guess, you are sick." Radko was one of that select group of hard chargers in the production business who kept morning hours, and that was good for me, because with Clover working days and going to law school at night, and the baby, of course, my own availability was restricted to the daylight hours when Violetta's own children were at school and her husband at work, operating one of the cranes that lifted the beams to build the city out till there was nothing green left for miles around. But Radko had promised me career advancement, moving up from logging footage to actual editing, and that hadn't happened. On this particular morning, as on too many mornings in the past, I felt I just couldn't face the editing bay, the computer screen, the eternal idiocy of the dialogue repeated over and over through take after take, frame after frame. "No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop. No, Jim, stop." I used to be in a band. I had a college degree. I was no drudge. Before I could think, it was out. "It's the baby," I said. There was a silence I might have read too much into. Then Radko, dicing the interrogative, said, "What baby?" "Mine, my baby. Remember the pictures Clover emailed everybody?" My brain was doing cartwheels. "9 months ago, when she was born?" Another long pause. Finally, he said, "Yes?" "Well, she's sick. Very, very sick, with a fever and all that. We don't know what's wrong with her." The wheel of internal calculus spun one more time, and I made another leap, the one that would prove to be fatal. "I'm at the hospital now." As soon as I hung up, I felt as if I'd been pumped full of helium, giddy with it, rising right out of my seat. But then the slow seepage of guilt, dread, and fear started in, drip by drip, like bile drained out of a liver gone bad. A delivery truck pulled up next to me. Rain beat at the windshield. Two cholos rolled out of the apartment next to Violetta's, the green block tattoos they wore like collars glistening in the light trapped beneath the clouds. I had the whole day in front of me. I could do anything, go anywhere. An hour ago, it was sleep I wanted. Now it was something else. A pulse of excitement, the promise of illicit thrills, started up in my stomach. I drove down Ventura Boulevard in the opposite direction from the bulk of the commuters. They were stalled at the lights, a single driver in every car, the cars themselves like steel shells they'd extruded to contain their resentments. They were going to work. I wasn't. After a mile or so, I came to a diner where I sometimes took Clover for breakfast on Sundays, especially if we'd been out the night before. And on an impulse, I pulled into the lot. I bought a newspaper from the machine out front, and then I took a copy of the free paper, too, and went on in and settled into a seat by the window. The smell of fresh coffee and home fries made me realize how hungry I was, and I ordered the kind of breakfast I used to have in college after a night of excess. Salt, sugar, and grease, in quantity, just to open my pores. While I ate, I made my way through both newspapers, item by item, because this was luxurious, kingly. The tables clean, the place brightly lit and warm to the point of steaming with the bustle of waitresses and the rain at the windows like a plague. Nobody said a word to me. Nobody even looked at me, but for my waitress. She was middle-aged, wedded to her uniform, her hair dyed shoe polish black. "More coffee?" she asked, for the third or fourth time. No hurry, no rush, just an invitation. I glanced at my watch and couldn't believe it was only 9:30. You see, that was the thing about taking a day off, the way the time reconfigured itself and how you couldn't help comparing any given moment with what you'd be doing at work. At work, I wouldn't have eaten yet, wouldn't even have reached the coffee break. "Jim, stop! No, no!" And my eyelids would have weighed 100 tons each. I thought about driving down to the ocean to see what the surf looked like under the pressure of the storm. Not that I was thinking about surfing. I hadn't been surfing more than a handful of times since the baby was born. It was just that the day was mine, and I wanted to fill it. I wound my way down through Topanga Canyon, the commuter traffic dissipated by now, and I saw how the creek was tearing at the banks, and there were two or three places where there was water on the road, and the soft red dough of the mud was like something that had come out of a mold. There was nobody on the beach but me. I walked along the shore till the brim of my baseball cap was sodden and the legs of my jeans as heavy as if they'd just come out of the washing machine. I drove back up the canyon. The rain a little worse, the flooding more obvious and intense, but it wasn't anything really. Not like when the road washes out and you could be driving one minute and the next flailing for your life in a chute of piss-yellow water. There was a movie at 2 I was interested in. But since it was only just past 12, and I couldn't even think about lunch after the lumberjack special I'd had for breakfast, I went back to the condo, parked the car, and walked down the street getting wetter and wetter and enjoying every minute of it to a bar I knew. The door swung in on a denseness of purpose. 8 or 9 losers lined up on their bar stools, the smell of cut lime and the sunshine of the rum, a straight shot of Lysol from the toilet and back. It was warm, dark. A college basketball game hovered on the screen above the cash register. "A beer," I said, and then clarified by specifying the brand. I didn't get drunk. That would have been usual, and I didn't want to be usual. But I did have 3 beers before I went to the movie, and after the movie, I felt a vacancy in my lower reaches where lunch should have been, and so I stopped at a fast food place on my way to pick up the baby. They got my order wrong. The employees were glassy-eyed, the manager was nowhere to be seen, and I was 35 minutes late for the baby. Still, I'd had my day, and when I got home, I fed the baby her cream of wheat, opened a beer, put on some music, and began chopping garlic and dicing onions with the notion of concocting a marinara sauce for my wife when she got home. Thoughts of the following morning, of Radko and what he might think or expect, never entered my mind. Not yet. All was well. The baby in her crib, batting at the little figurines in the mobile over her head. The sauce bubbling on the stove, the rain tapping at the windows. I heard Clover's key in the door. And then she was there with her hair kinked from the rain and smelling like everything I'd ever wanted, and she was asking me how my day had gone, and I said, "Fine, just fine." Then it was morning again, and the same scene played itself out. Clover stutter-stepping to the bathroom, the baby mewling, rain whispering under the soundtrack, and I began to calculate all over again. It was Thursday. 2 more days to the weekend. If I could make it to the weekend, I was sure that by Monday at the latest, whatever was wrong with me, this feeling of anger, hopelessness, turmoil, whatever it was, would be gone. Just a break. I just needed a break, that was all. And Radko, The thought of facing him, of the way he would mold the drooping dog-like folds of his Slavic flesh around the suspicion in his eyes while he told me he was docking me a day's pay and expecting me to work overtime to make up for yesterday, was too much to hold on to. Not in bed. Not now. But then the toilet flushed, the baby squalled, and the overhead light went on. "It's 6:15," my wife informed me. The evening before, after we'd dined on my marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and Italian-style turkey sausage over penne pasta, in the interval before she put the baby down for the night, while the dishwasher murmured from the kitchen and we lingered over a second glass of Chianti, she told me she was thinking of changing her name. "What do you mean?" I was more surprised than angry, but I felt the anger come up in me all the same. "Like, my name's not good enough for you? Like it was my idea to get married in the first place?" She had the baby in her lap. The baby was in high spirits, grinning her toothless baby grin and snatching for the wine glass my wife held just out of reach. "You don't have to get nasty about it," she said. "It's not your name that's the problem. It's mine. My first name. What's wrong with Clover?" I said, and even as I said it, I knew how stupid I sounded. She was Clover. I could close my eyes and she was Clover. Go to Africa and bury myself in mud and she'd still be Clover. Fine. But the name was a hippie affectation of her hippie parents. They were glassblowers with their own gallery. And it was insipid. I knew that, down deep. They might as well have named her Dandelion or Fescue. I was thinking of changing it to Chloris. She was watching me, her eyes defiant and insecure at the same time. Legally? I saw her point. She was a legal secretary studying to be a lawyer, and Clover just wouldn't fly on a masthead. But I hated the name, hated the idea. "Sounds like something you clean the toilet with," I said. She shot me a look of hate. "With bleach in it," I said, "with real scrubbing power." But now, though I felt as if I'd been crucified and wanted only to sleep for a week, till Monday, just till Monday, I sat up before she could lift the baby from the crib and drop her on the bed, and the next moment I was in the bathroom myself, staring into the mirror. As soon as she left, I was going to call Radko. I would tell him the baby was worse, that we'd been in the hospital all night. And if he asked what was wrong, I wasn't going to equivocate, because equivocation, any kind of uncertainty, a tremor in the voice, a tonal shift, play acting, is the surest lie detector. Leukemia, that was what I was going to tell him. The baby has leukemia. This time, I waited till I was settled into the booth at the diner, and the waitress with the shoe polish hair had got done fussing over me, the light of recognition in her eyes and a maternal smile creasing her lips. I was a regular, 2 days in a row, before I called in. And when Radko answered, the deepest consonant battering pole of suspicion lodged somewhere between his glottis and adenoids, I couldn't help myself. "The baby," I said, holding it a beat. "The baby passed." Another beat. The waitress poured. Radko breathed fumes through the receiver. "Last night at 4 a.m., there was nothing they could do." "Passed?" His voice came back at me. "What is this past?" "The baby's dead," I said. "She died." And then, in my brief, I broke the connection. I spent the entire day at the movies. The first show was at 11, and I killed time pacing around the parking lot at the mall till they opened the doors, and then I was inside in the anonymous dark. Images flashed by on the screen. The sound was amplified to a killing roar. The smell of melted butter hung over everything. When the lights came up, I ducked into the men's room and then slipped into the next theater and the next one after that. I emerged at 4:15, feeling shaky. I told myself I was hungry, that was all. But when I wandered into the food court and saw what they had arrayed there, from chapatis to corn dogs to twice-cooked machaca, pretzels and Sichuan eggplant and a sauce of liquid fire, I pushed through the door of a bar instead. It was one of those over-sanitized, too bright, echoing spaces the mall designers, in their wisdom, stuck in the back of their plastic restaurants so that the average moron accompanying his wife on a shopping expedition wouldn't have to kill himself. There was a basketball game on the three TVs encircling the bar. The waitresses were teenagers. The bartender had acne. I was the only customer, and I knew I had to pick up the baby. That was a given. That was a fact of life. But I ordered a Captain and Coke just for the smell of it. I was on my second or maybe my third when the place began to fill up, and I realized with a stab of happiness that this must have been an after-work hangout with a prescribed happy hour and some sort of comestibles served up gratis on a heated tray. I'd been wrapped up in my grief, a grief that was all for myself, for the fact that I was 26 years old and going nowhere with a baby to take care of and a wife in the process of flogging a law degree and changing her name because she wasn't who she used to be. And now suddenly, I'd come awake. There were women everywhere. Women my age and older, leaning into the bar with their earrings swaying, lined up at the door, sitting at tables, legs crossed, feet tapping rhythmically to the canned music. Me, I had to pick up the baby. I checked my watch and saw now that I was already late, late for the second day running. But I was hungry all of a sudden, and I thought I'd just maybe have a couple of the taquitos everybody else was stuffing into their mouths while I finished my drink. Then I'd get in the car, take the back streets to Violetta's, and be home just before my wife and see if we could get another meal out of the marinara sauce with porcini mushrooms and turkey sausage. That was when I felt a pressure on my arm, my left arm, and I lifted my chin to glance over my shoulder into the face of Joel Chinowski, who occupied the bay next to mine at Iron House Productions. At first, I didn't recognize him, one of those tricks of the mind, the inebriated mind especially, in which you can't really place people out of context, though you know them absolutely. "Joel," I said. He was shaking his head very slowly, as if he were tolling a bell, as if his eyes were the clappers and his skull the ringing shell of it. He had a big head, huge. He was big all around, one of those people who aren't obese or not exactly, but just overgrown to the extent that his clothes seemed inflated, his pants, his jacket, even his socks. He was wearing a tie, the only one of the 76 employees at Iron House to dress in shirt and tie, and it looked like a toy trailing away from his supersized collar. "Oh, shit, man," he said, squeezing tighter. "Yeah," I said, and my head was tolling, too. I felt caught out, felt like the very essence he was naming, like that is. "Oh, man, we all heard," he said. He removed his hand from my arm, peered into his palm as if trying to divine what to say next. "It sucks," he said. "It really sucks." "Yeah," I said. And then, though his face never changed expression, he seemed to brighten around the eyes for just an instant. "Hey," he said, "can I buy you a drink? I mean, to drown the sorrow. I mean, that's what you're doing, right? And I don't blame you, not at all. If it was me..." He let the thought trail off. There was a girl two stools down from me, her hair pulled up in a long, trailing ponytail, and she was wearing a knit jumper over a little black skirt and red leggings. She glanced up at me, two green swimming eyes above a pair of lips pursed at the straw of her drink. Or maybe," Joel said, "you'd rather be alone?" I dragged my eyes away from the girl. "The truth is," I said, "I mean, I really appreciate it, but like I'm meeting Clover at the, well, the funeral parlor, you know, to make the arrangements. And it's, I just stopped in for a drink, that's all." "Oh, man." Joel was practically erupting from his shoes, his face drawn down like a curtain and every blood vessel in his eyes gone to waste. "I understand. I understand completely." On the way out the door, I flipped open my cell and dialed Violetta to tell her my wife would be picking up the baby tonight because I was working late. And then I left a message to the same effect at my wife's law office. Then I went looking for a bar where I could find something to eat and maybe one last drink before I went home to lie some more. The next day, Friday, I didn't even bother to call in, but I was feeling marginally better. I had a mild hangover, my head still clanging dully, and my stomach shriveled up around a little nugget of nothing so that after I dropped the baby off, I wasn't able to take anything more than dry toast and black coffee at the diner that was fast becoming my second home. And yet the force of the lie, the enormity of it, was behind me. And here, outside the windows, the sun was shining for the first time in days. I'd been listening to the surf report in the car on the way over. We were getting 6-foot swells as a result of the storm. And after breakfast, I dug out my wetsuit and board and let the Pacific roll on under me until I forgot everything in the world but the taste of salt and the smell of the breeze and the weird, strangled cries of the gulls. I was home by 3, and I vacuumed, washed the dishes, scrubbed the counters. I was 20 minutes early to pick up Xana, and while dinner was cooking, meatloaf with boiled potatoes in their skins and asparagus vinaigrette, I took her to the park and listened to her screech with baby joy as I held her in my lap and rocked higher and higher on the swings. When Clover came home, she was too tired to fight, and she accepted the meatloaf and the wine I'd picked out as the peace offerings they were, and after the baby was asleep, we listened to music, smoked a joint, and made love in a slow, deep plunge that was like paddling out on a wave of flesh for what seemed like hours. We took a drive up the coast on Saturday, and on Sunday, We went over to Tank's for lunch and saw how sad his apartment was with its brick and board bookcases, the faded band posters curling away from the walls, and the deep pile rug that was once off-white and was now just plain dirty. In the car on the way home, Clover said she never could understand people who treated their dog as if they'd given birth to it, and I shook my head, tolling it, but easily now, thankfully, and said I couldn't agree more. I woke on Monday before the alarm went off, and I was showered and shaved and in the car before my wife left for work. And when I pulled up in front of the long, windowless, gray stucco edifice that housed Iron House Productions, I was so early, Radko himself hadn't showed up yet. I took off my watch and stuffed it deep in my pocket, letting the monotony of work drag me down till I was conscious of nothing, not my fingers at the keyboard or the image on the screen or the dialogue I was capturing frame by frozen frame. At some point, it might have been an hour in, 2 hours, I don't know, I became aware of the intense, gland-clenching aroma of vanilla chai, hot, spiced, blended, the very thing I wanted, caffeine to drive a stake into the boredom. Vanilla chai, available at the coffee house down the street, but a real indulgence because of the cost. Usually, I made do with the acidic black coffee and artificial creamer Radko provided on a stained cart set up against the back wall. I lifted my head to search out the aroma, and there was Jeannie, the secretary from the front office, holding a paperboard venti in one hand and a platter of what turned out to be homemade cannoli in the other. "What?" I said, thinking Radko had sent her to tell me he wanted to see me in his office. But she didn't say anything for a long, excruciating moment, her eyes full, her face white as a mask. And then she shoved the chai into my hand and set the tray down on the desk beside me. "I am so sorry for your loss," she said. And then I felt her hand on my shoulder, and she was dipping forward in a typhoon of perfume to plant a lugubrious kiss just beneath my left ear. What can I say? I felt bad about the whole business, felt low and despicable. But I cracked the plastic lid and sipped the chai, and as if I weren't even conscious of what my fingers were doing, I started in on the cannoli one by one till the platter was bare. I was just sucking the last of the sugar from my fingertips when Steve Bartholomew, a guy of 30 or so who worked in special effects, a guy I barely knew, came up to me and without a word pressed a tin of butter cookies into my hand. "Hey," I said, addressing his retreating shoulders, "thanks, man, thanks, it means a lot." By noon, my desk was piled high with foodstuffs, sandwiches, sweets, a dry salami as long as my forearm, and at least a dozen gray-jacketed sympathy cards inscribed by one coworker or another. I wanted to hide, wanted to quit, wanted to go home, tear the phone out of the wall, get into bed, and never leave. But I didn't. I just sat there, trying to work, giving one person after another a zombie smile and my best impression of the thousand-yard stare. Just before quitting time, Radko appeared, his face like an old paper bag left out in the rain. He was flanked by Joel Chinowski. I glanced up at them out of wary eyes, and in a flash of intuition, I realized how much I hated them both, how much I wanted only to jump to my feet like a cornered animal and punch them out, both of them. Radko said nothing. He just stood there, gazing down at me. And then after a moment, he pressed one hand to my shoulder in Slavic commiseration, turned and walked away. "Listen, man," Joel said, shifting his eyes away from mine. "We all wanted to, But we got together, me and some of the others, and I know it isn't much, but..." I saw now that he was holding a plastic grocery sack in one hand. I knew what was in the sack. I tried to wave it away, but he thrust it at me, and I had no choice but to take it. Later, when I got home, and the baby was in her high chair, smearing her face with cream of wheat, and I'd slipped the microwave pizza out of its box, I sat down and emptied the contents of the bag on the kitchen table. It was mainly cash. But there were maybe half a dozen checks, too. I saw one for $25, another for $50. The baby made one of those expressions of baby joy, sharp and sudden, as if the impulse had seized her before she could process it. It was 5:30, and the sinking sun was pasted over the windows. I sifted the bills through my hands, tens and twenties, fives, a lot of fives, and surprisingly few singles, thinking how generous my coworkers were, how good and real and giving. But I was grieving all the same. Grieving beyond any measure I could ever have imagined or contained. I was in the process of counting the money, thinking I'd give it back or donate it to some charity, when I heard Clover's key in the lock, and I swept it all back into the bag and tucked that bag in the deep recess under the sink where the water persistently dripped from the crusted-over pipe and the old sponge there smelled of mold. The minute my wife left the next morning, I called Radko and told him I wasn't coming in. He didn't ask for an excuse, but I gave him one anyway. The funeral, I said. It's at 11 a.m., just family, very private. My wife is taking it hard. He made some sort of noise on the other end of the line. A sigh, a belch, the faintest cracking of his knuckles. Tomorrow, I said. I'll be in tomorrow without fail. And then the day began. But it wasn't like that first day, not at all. I didn't feel giddy, didn't feel liberated or even relieved. All I felt was regret and the cold drop of doom. I deposited the baby at Violetta's and went straight home to bed, wanting only to clear some space for myself and think things out. There was no way I could return the money. I wasn't that good of an actor. And I couldn't spend it either, even to make up for the loss of pay. That would have been low, lower than anything I'd ever done in my life. I thought of Clover then, how furious she'd be when she found out my pay had been docked. If it had been docked, there was still a chance Radko would let it slide, given the magnitude of my tragedy. A chance that he was human after all, a good chance. No, the only thing to do was to bury the money someplace. I'd burn the checks first. I couldn't run the risk of anybody uncovering them. That would be a real disaster, magnitude 10. Nobody could explain that. Though various scenarios were already suggesting themselves. A thief had stolen the bag from the glove box of my car. It had blown out the window on the freeway while I was on my way to the mortuary. The neighbor's pet macaque had come in through the open bathroom window and made off with it, wadding the checks and chewing up the money till it was just monkey feces now. Monkey feces, monkey feces. I found myself repeating the phrase over and over as if it were a prayer. It was a little past 9 when I had my first beer, and for the rest of the day, till I had to pick up the baby, I never moved from the couch. I tried to gauge Clover's mood when she came in the door, dressed like a lawyer in her gray herringbone jacket and matching skirt, her hair pinned up and her eyes in traffic mode. The place was a mess. I hadn't picked up, hadn't put on anything for dinner. The baby, asleep in her molded plastic carrier, gave off a stink you could smell all the way across the room. I looked up from my beer. I thought we'd go out tonight, I told her. My treat. And then, because I couldn't help myself, I added, I'm just trashed from work. She wasn't happy about it. I could see that. Lawyerly calculations transfiguring her face as she weighed the hassle of running up the boulevard with her husband and baby in tow before leaving for her 8 o'clock class. I watched her reach back to remove the clip from her hair and shake it loose. Oh, I guess, she said, but no Italian. She'd set down her briefcase in the entry hall where the phone was and put a thumb in her mouth. And she said, what about Chinese? And then she shrugged. As long as it's quick, she added, I don't really care. I was about to agree with her, about to rise up out of the grip of the couch and do my best to minister to the baby and get us out the door en famille, when the phone rang. Clover answered. Hello, this is she. My right knee cracked as I stood, a reminder of the torn ACL I'd suffered in high school when I'd made the slightest miscalculation regarding the drop off the backside of a boulder while snowboarding at Mammoth. Jeannie, my wife said, her eyebrows lifting in two perfect arches. Yes, she said, yes, Jeannie, how are you? There was a long pause as Jeannie said what she was going to say, and then my wife said, oh no, there must be some mistake. The baby's fine. She's right here in her carrier, fast asleep. And her voice grew heartier, surprise and confusion riding the cusp of the joke. She could use a fresh diaper, judging from the smell of her, but that's her daddy's job, or it's going to be if we ever expect to. And then there was another pause, longer this time, and I watched my wife's gaze shift from the form of the sleeping baby in her terry cloth jumpsuit to where I was standing beside the couch. Her eyes, in soft focus for the baby, hardened as they climbed from my shoe tops to my face where they rested like two balls of granite. Anybody would have melted under that kind of scrutiny. My wife, the lawyer. It would be a long night. I could see that. There would be no Chinese, no food of any kind. I found myself denying everything, telling her how scattered Jeannie was and how she must have mixed us up with the Lovett. She remembered Tony Lovett, worked in SFX. Yeah, they just lost their baby, a little girl. Yeah, it was awful. I told her we'd all chipped in. Me too. I put in a 50, and that was excessive, I know it, but I felt I had to, you know, because of the baby, because what if it happened to us? I went on in that vein till I ran out of breath. And when I tried to be nonchalant about it and go to the refrigerator for another beer, she blocked my way. Where's the money? She said. We were 2 feet apart. I didn't like the look she was giving me because it spared nothing. I could have kept it up. Could have said, "What money?" injecting all the trampled innocence I could summon into my voice, but I didn't. I merely bent to the cabinet under the sink, extracted the white plastic bag, and handed it to her. She took it as if it were the bleeding corpse of our daughter. Or no, of our relationship that went back 3 years to the time when I was up on stage, gilded in light, my message elided under the hammer of the guitar and the thump of the bass. She didn't look inside. She just held my eyes. "You know this is fraud, don't you?" she said. "A felony offense. They can lock you up for this. You know that?" She wasn't asking a question. She was making a demand. And I wasn't about to answer her, because the baby was dead, and she was dead too. Radko was dead, Jeannie the secretary, whose last name I didn't even know, and Joel Chernowski and all the rest of them. Very slowly, button by button, I did up my shirt. Then I set my empty beer bottle down on the counter as carefully as if it were full to the lip, and went out the door and into the night, looking for somebody I could tell all about it. Thank you. Thank you. So you see what fun it is to get a story instead of just talk about it. And thank you. You're a great audience. I haven't mentioned also that you are physically beautiful. In fact, the most physically beautiful audience I've had on this entire tour. So congratulations, folks. I'm happy to take your questions. And if you've scrawled them out on cards, I'll accept them now and we'll see what we can do. Is there a character you've created that continues to linger in your consciousness? Wow. You know, it's a good question, but as an artist, I am always looking to move on. For instance, in San Miguel, I'm writing from the point of view of women, a 15-year-old girl in 1890. I try to do what I haven't done before, so I really don't look back much. I will say that a character like the one I've just presented to you seems more natural for me to write. I mean, that's the sort of character. I'm not at all like this guy. I'm a saint. You can see I am a saint. I'm nothing like this. But I do have sympathy with the angry, disaffected male. You've seen them in a couple of my books, like in When the Killing's Done, the antagonist, who was the rat savior, by the way. I named him Dave LaJoy. And he's one of these guys who is angry at everything, angry all the time. Really obnoxious, but he has one principle, and the principle is thou shalt not kill. And so he goes head to head with the biologist, who feels the same. They're both vegetarians. They could have been allies, but they're fighting a war. She feels that these creatures must be eliminated, pigs, rats, because they are throughout the world, whereas these beautiful little island foxes and island skunks only exist on the islands. And by the way, to show you how improvisatory this all is, everything, the story you've heard, the beginning of the novel, everything is just an improvisation. It just happens. I just follow it. In the middle of writing the novel, this happened to my friend, who was a lawyer in San Francisco in her mid-50s, and she's divorced, so looking to date. So she found a guy online who claimed to be tall and a lawyer, too. He was short, he wasn't a lawyer, but what the hell. She had a date with him at her favorite Italian place in her village where she lives in the Bay Area, where they know her very well, figuring if anything goes wrong, at least I'm in this place where everybody knows me, and it's a very nice restaurant. So the guy came in, and okay, he wasn't tall and he wasn't a lawyer, but what the heck, they're on the date. And so he claimed to be a great enophile, a great wine lover, and so he brought over the sommelier and ordered the single most expensive bottle of wine on the entire menu. The guy opened it, poured in a taste, the waiter poured a taste. He sniffed it, tasted it, spat it right out and said, "It's rot gut, throw it away." Then he ordered the second most expensive bottle and did the same thing, at which point my friend walked out. So she told me this story, and I immediately incorporated it into the novel because before they became antagonists, Dave LaJoy and Alma Boyd Takasui, the biologist, had had a date, and that was the catastrophic date. What is the key to creating believable fictional characters? I don't know. I truly don't know. You just have to dwell in the work. When I first began writing, my wife would always complain that my women characters were flat. But I counter by saying, well, so are my male characters. Because I really didn't work much with character. When I first began, look at my first book, Descent of Man. The story's there. I was much more concerned with design, language, and idea, and characters were just one element in all of this. As I began to write novels, and I hope grew as a writer, I began to see that I could create more viable and vivid and enduring characters, credible characters, like the guy you just heard in this story. And so I've tried then also to do this with women characters. The first was Ruth Dershowitz in East is East back in 1990, the three wives of Frank Lloyd Wright, and the women, the deaf woman in Talk Talk. But this novel is the first one I've written entirely from the point of view of women. I'd want to address what I haven't done and see if I can do it. And I'll leave you with this. My happiest and most proud moment in this regard is in a story called Big Game, which I wrote in the late 1980s, when I discovered in the LA Times that there was a game farm near Bakersfield in which people could hunt elephants, lions, tigers, etc., that were, you know, retired from the circus for $10,000. You don't have to go to Africa. You can go blow these animals away. And I wondered about this. You know, I just wondered about it. And so in it, there is an old circus elephant. You know, she's like 50 years old. Her name is Bessie B, and she's really fed up. And so I enter into her mind for two paragraphs while these apes are scurrying around her. And they don't do very well, those apes. That's us. That's us. We're the apes. All right, folks. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.